This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Racial identity is complex. Still, most applications ask us to simply please check one box next to common classifications like white, African American, Asian, Hispanic, Indian, or other, one of those to identify ourselves. Now, maybe you don't think much about it, but when you make that selection, what are you saying about who you are and what you look like? What goes into deciding race? Skin color is perhaps the most influential factor in determining racial identity, but defining race hasn't always been black and white in America. In fact, legal definitions of race were once so vague and varied that families considered African American in one part of the country could be classified as white in another. But no matter the pigmentation, skin color has had a long connection to social privilege. On today's show, we're going to examine that relationship and question common ideas about race related to skin tone. We want to hear from you. We're taking your calls and emails. How has your skin color been a benefit or a burden to you? Which box do you select on applications and why? Have you ever been mistaken for another race? Have you ever deliberately passed for another race? We're happy to hear your stories at 877-962-9862. Emails, sot@wunc.org. Well, the decision to check one box is undoubtedly a tough one for my first guest. Helen Bethea lives in Fayetteville, North Carolina. She's 68 years old, and she's been suffering from a racial identity crisis since the age of six. Helen's birth certificate reads that she's white, like her parents and siblings. But Helen's appearance, in particular her darker skin tone, got her banished from her then segregated public school system in the South Carolina town where she was born. Helen was taken in by an African-American family in a neighboring city. She was allowed to attend school in her adopted black community, and she recounts her experience and her search for a racial identity in a new memoir, A Life Divided. Helen Bethea joins me now by phone from her home in Fayetteville. Welcome to State of Things, Helen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. It's good to have you here, and also Daniel Sharfstein. He's a law professor at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of a new book called The Invisible Line, Three African-American Families, and the Journey from Black to White, and he joins us from a studio on the campus of Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, Frank.
Helen, I want to hear your story first. Tell us about your biological family and the years you spent with them in Rock Hill, South Carolina.
Oh, actually, that was Society Hill, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
But I was with them until I became 7 years old. And then at that point, I was no longer... Basically, I was not allowed to live with them in a way because of the fact that I was not allowed to go to school. And that was based on my texture of my hair, which was curly, and skin tone.
How did that happen? Tell us about that time in school when you were told to leave.
Well, I think I went one day with my older sister and my brother. And I didn't even spend a day there. I was told once I got there that she's not one of us. She's not white enough. Therefore, she's not allowed to go to school here. She cannot come back. And I was not allowed to go to the, as they called it back then, the colored school because they knew my family was white.
Right.
Therefore, I was not allowed to attend school at all.
Was that a surprise to you when you were told that you were not white enough for the white school? Had you ever noticed a difference up until then?
You know, actually, no, I didn't. It just never fazed me. I don't know if that had anything to do with my age or the fact that my family never really voiced it. So it didn't. That's part of the thing that I'm going through as far as understanding, because it was just never brought up again. And I guess being that age and not having to go to school, you know,
right,
play all the time. So that was, it was not an issue with me at that age.
And your birth certificate clearly says that you are white.
Yes, yes, yes. The original birth certificate that I saw at the age of 18 that my adopted mother had, and she made some corrections on there where my race was. She marked it out with bleach at that time and wrote in colored because it had white
Well, what did your mother do when she got the news that you weren't allowed to return to the school because you were classified black?
Well, my mother, like I said, at that age, I can't really say because I don't know. My father had passed, my biological father had passed, and I know she was under pressure as far as social services. They didn't call it that back then. They called it welfare people. She was reported to the welfare office that there was, she had a child that was not in school, and they would come to investigate, and if she knew they were coming, my sister would hide me in the cornfield or the tobacco barn or the smokehouse because they didn't want me, you know, they didn't want, because they were going to put me in a reform school or an orphanage.
Well, Daniel Sharfstein, if her mother, if Helen's mother wanted to back then, was there any legal recourse to going back to the school system, showing them the birth certificate and getting Helen in school?
Absolutely. And I mean, listening to the story, it's really an incredibly powerful story. Shows that race was never just about a designation on a birth certificate. It also had a lot to do with personal relationships and community dynamics and what the administrative state thought it could do to individuals. In communities all over the South, there were people who looked dark but were attending white schools. And there were traditionally, for decades and decades, really hundreds of years, narratives for why people could be dark in appearance but still white. They had Native American ancestry, or they were Portuguese, which you know, there was essentially a designation that people referred to as Carolina Portuguese, or they were something else entirely. North Carolina is known for Lumbee Indians, the Lumbee Native American group, and there were all kinds of other groups that were known as the little races. But often these were ways that communities could accommodate physical difference with the black-white, the starkness of the line between black and white.
Well, Helen,
this really...
Well, I want to ask Helen a question here, if I may, for just one moment, and that is whether you felt the need to explain after that that you looked different. You were adopted eventually by an African-American woman and who changed your birth certificate, lived in a black community, moved away and lived in a black community.
Right.
Did you feel the need after that to explain who you were and why you looked the way you did?
The only thing, when I became part of the African-American family, I would talk to kids or whatever that I had met. I talked with them. You know, they have brothers. I have a sister. They're white. And my adopted mother found out that I had, you know, you just, everybody's got a sister, everybody's got a brother, so you're expressing these things. So she often said to me, Helen, you cannot tell anyone where you came from. You cannot tell people that your family is white, because if you do, then the Ku Klux Klan could burn across in my yard, and it could create a problem that I have a white person living in my house. So from that point, I was forbidden to discuss who my family was. Therefore, from that point on, I never voiced it. I never said anything about it, and it never came up. The community that I lived in, no one asked questions.
Did you find that you had to change the way, in addition to keeping your story a secret, that you had to act differently than you had living with your white family now that you'd moved away and were living in a new community?
You mean now?
No, when you were growing up.
When I was growing up. No, actually, I guess because I was so young, and I blended in. And the lady that adopted me, she was very fair-skinned, sort of Indian descent, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so I just blended in. And her mother was very light. So actually, I could have been her child. But knowing the fact that I wasn't, you know, they should not give them birth to me was that was, you know, understanding. But no, I never had any thoughts about, you know, why am I here? Who am I? Why am I different? You know, that's amazing to me.
How about now? Do you identify as a white woman, a black woman?
Well, that's where I am as far as my identity is concerned now. The truth is I am white. My biological family is still in South Carolina. My mother has passed. She's deceased now. But when I go back to visit with my family, it's kind of weird because I don't know. It's just they accept me. I am who I am with them. But it's me because I'm sitting there and I'm wondering, what are you thinking? Who, you know, are you? Because I grew up in the African-American culture, I just wonder sometimes what they're thinking. But as far as I can tell, they always, you know, my sister, I love you, and it's not overwhelming with them. It's just I'm part of them. But me, it's kind of strange. And then when I leave and I come back to Fayetteville, I'm back into the world that I grew up in, that I know. And it's kind of confusing to me at times.
Well, Helen, I want to thank you very much for being on the program. Helen Bethea is the author of the memoir, A Life Divided, and our conversation about race, racial identity, and skin tone continues on The State of Things with your phone calls and emails, 877-962-9862, on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Skin color has long been connected to social privilege, and while it's true the most common narrative depicts fair-skinned folks ranking at the top of society's hierarchy, there are many documented cases of racial minorities rejecting white classification in order to build successful status in marginalized communities. Legal scholar Daniel Sharfstein is my guest today. He has written a book about three Southern families that walked the color line from black to white and back again in some cases. One of the families he focuses on has roots right here in North Carolina. Daniel's book is called The Invisible Line. We're taking your calls and emails this hour as well, 877-962-9862, sot@wunc.org. Want to hear your stories if you have ever been mistaken for a person of another race, or if you have deliberately passed as a person from another race, known family members who have had the same experience. Call us at 877-962-9862. Send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Daniel Sharfstein, as you hear Helen Bethea's story and the confusion over her identity now and how to relate to even members of her family, actually, from reading your book, there should be a lot more of that, given the amount of mixing that went on without people really telling that story or passing the story down to subsequent generations.
That's true. You know, every family has its secrets, and for many, many Americans, this is it. What's really interesting today with the advent of DNA ancestry testing and the proliferation of genealogical material on the internet, more and more people are discovering that this is their story every day.
Tell us about the Walls, one of the three families that you write about in your book. The Walls' ancestry you trace back to Rockingham, North Carolina.
That's right. Their story is probably, it begins in the most familiar way to a modern reader. Began on a North Carolina plantation, Rockingham, and it began with a slave owner who never married, but he had children with three women whom he owned. And then the story becomes a little less familiar. He freed his children and sent them to Ohio to be raised and educated by radical Quaker abolitionists right at the end of the 1830s, beginning of the 1840s. And these children were living in Ohio. They had plenty of property, but their mothers were still in North Carolina enslaved. They grew up and moved to Oberlin, Ohio, which was the most abolitionist town in America in the 1850s. They became ardent civil rights activists, recruited black soldiers, hundreds of black soldiers, for the Massachusetts 54th and other African-American regiments, and then participated in the Freedmen's Bureau and moved to Washington, D.C., where they were part of the rising black political class during Reconstruction. And they raised their children in integrated schools in Washington and raised them to expect a full place at the table, the same kinds of rights and opportunities that everyone else could expect. And their children, the next generation, came of age right as Reconstruction ended. And it was like a door had slammed shut. And one by one, they moved to different neighborhoods in Washington or to different cities, and they faded into the white world.
So when possible, after that first generation, they chose to identify white when they could.
That's right. And interestingly, one family had an experience very similar to Ms. Bethea. So one family, one branch moved to a neighborhood in Washington and sent their child to a white school. They didn't change their name. They just thought they could become white by keeping their mouths shut. And she went to the first grade at the local public school and was kicked out. And then they did actually what a lot of families did and what Ms. Bethea's family could have done, which was they went to court and challenged the expulsion. They said, you can't just do this without evidence. You have to prove it, and you bear the burden of proof.
877-962-9862 is the number to call. We're talking about racial identity and skin tone today on the program. My guest is Daniel Sharfstein. He is the author of The Invisible Line, Three American Families. And we're going to go to the phones now where Alex is on the line from Fayetteville. Hello, Alex.
Hi, how's it going, sir?
Good, good. Do you have a question for us or a story to tell?
Yeah. My story is I was born in Haiti and I was raised in Boston, Massachusetts. And I'm in the Army now, and if you saw me, I guess I would pass as biracial, or I've been told. But in Haiti, I just come from a group of light-skinned black people that have always been there, because obviously the French, it's a former French slave colony. But when we immigrate to the United States, you know, we're all black. But growing up, and recently in the military, a lot of my peers will be like, oh, you're not black, you're Haitian. And I'm like, well, I guess it's my ethnicity. But in terms of race, I guess, you know, I'm black. I have lots of mixed or biracial-looking people in my family, but for all intents and purposes, we're descendants of slaves on a tiny island in the Caribbean. You know, like, we're black. And I always got it as, I guess in their minds, and it's not their fault, they assume, well, subconsciously, I suspect that they think black is negative, and so why would you want to identify as black? It's better just say that you're Haitian, you know, and I've encountered that from young, old, educated, you know, blue-collar,
Well, it's an interesting. I want to ask you, if I may, and forgive me for interrupting, Alex, but I'm curious to know, not necessarily how you respond to that, but whether that changes how you feel you're expected to act once somebody says, well, no, you're Haitian, you're not black. Do you feel like you have to sort of perform in a different way because of their expectations?
No, not at all. And over the years, I think they've learned that, oh, he doesn't come across as a black American, which is what they mean.
Right.
You know, he doesn't sound like one. He speaks another language. I've heard him speak on the phone with his grandmother or his sister. And so for them, I'm not a black American, so I'm not black. I'm Haitian. And if you ask everyone in Haiti, everyone that suffered from the earthquake, I know that you're Haitian, but what are you? They would say, use the French word, noir. We're black people, just like the blacks in Africa, just like some of the blacks in the other Caribbean. But I guess in America, some people identify black as just being black American, like, you know.
Right, but
I thought that was interesting.
It is, Alex, and I thank you for your call. I'd like to ask Daniel Sharfstein how different it is to those racial distinctions in this country compared with other countries.
Every country has some set of distinctions that they make, and many of them are based on race. In the U.S., the African-American community is very diverse, and it's becoming more diverse as more and more people are immigrating from the Caribbean and from Africa. At the same time, there's all kinds of complexity relating to how people naturalize into American society. Do they continue to draw the distinctions of their nationality, or are they essentially naturalized into the African American experience? And it really goes to how how race is something that people identify with personally. It's a story that they tell about themselves, but it's also a story that lots of other people and the government imposes upon you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting part of Alex's story, I think, that he doesn't have he doesn't have a lot of choice when people expect certain things of a Haitian and different things of somebody who's African-American. You know, his choices are limited, it seems to me, in terms of what people expect from him. Performance is also an important part, and art, the way we render race, has been an important aspect in our cultural understanding. Adrienne Piper is an important contemporary artist. She makes both visual work and performance pieces that address important social questions about race and gender. But Adrienne's path as an artist was perhaps influenced long before her birth. Her grandmother and father were both faced with a decision to be classified as white or African-American. They chose African-American, and that choice influenced the creativity of Adrienne Piper a generation later. My next guest is the author of a new book about the artist Adrienne Piper. John P. Bowles is an associate professor of African-American art at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His book is called Adrienne Piper, Race, Gender, and Embodiment, and I'm pleased to welcome him to the studio now, John Bowles. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Before we talk about Adrienne Piper's work, tell us a bit about her family background.
Well, this is her family background is important to much of her work. She addresses it directly in an artwork she calls Cornered, in which she appears in a video, and on either side of the video monitor, she displays two birth certificates, her father's birth certificates. One on which his race is identified as white, and the other on which his race is identified as octoroon, which it was a sort of a legal term that meant 1/8 black. And she displays the two birth certificates as a way of addressing the history of race and of racial mixing, or what has often been described using another legal term as miscegenation, as a way of presenting the moral dilemmas, the everyday dilemmas that this history causes in a nation where many of us are encouraged to identify ourselves really very clearly according to those checkboxes you mentioned earlier, as white or black or something else. And so in Cornered, she presents these two birth certificates with a story that her when her father was born, and his family brought him home, the doctor, a well-meaning doctor, when he was born fair-skinned, gave him a birth certificate that identified him as white. And in a story that's sort of the reverse of Helen Bethea's very moving story, Piper's father's mother, Piper's grandmother, returned to the hospital, confronted the doctor, and insisted that he give her a birth certificate that identified her father as octoroon, that identified him as black. And to Piper, this is important because this demonstrates that given the opportunity to pass, her grandmother chose not to. And as she explains later in life, her father, when he had the opportunity to pass for white, for the most part, chose not to. The one exception she identifies is during World War II, when the military was segregated into black and white units, her father, she says, chose to pass for white so that he could serve in a combat unit when most African-American soldiers were not allowed to. So she presents this history as background as a way of, you know, in a sense, providing very personal evidence that these distinctions have a deep impact on people personally.
And how does she identify?
So she identifies herself. She identifies herself as black, and in the video Cornered, she begins with a simple statement: "I am black," and then she goes on to discuss how people have confused her for white, how many people who meet her assume she's white, and why she chooses to identify as black, and why she refuses to be silent about her racial identification too.
And Daniel Sharfstein, let's talk a little bit about this. We've, you know, heard the term octoroon, 1/8 black, and that made that you were legally black in this country. Mm. Talk about the legal history and how race was defined, because there have been many changes over the decades.
Sure. So the first actual rule that drew a line between black and white was Virginia in 1705. So that's relatively late in the American experience, 100 years after Virginia was first colonized. And the rule was a 1/8 rule. If you had a black great-grandparent, then you were legally black. And 80 years later, Virginia eased that up to a 1/4 rule. And all the while, there were plenty of people saying that there were white people who were legally white, who were socially accepted as white, who had African ancestry. And in a way, these rules were rough proxies to grandfather people in who were living as white. But most states that followed after Virginia subscribed to some fractional approximation of blood quantum. So there was a real patchwork. Virginia had a 1/4 rule. North Carolina had a 1/8 rule. And South Carolina actually, before the Civil War, never drew the line with some kind of genealogical fraction. Actually, there was a case in 1835 where a judge said it makes perfect sense to him that someone who had a high social standing, a good reputation, did good work, would be classified as white, and someone with an identical blood quantum who had a less lofty reputation would be classified as black. And that wasn't somebody who was a radical on race and slavery. This was Chancellor Harper, who was one of the most public proponents of slavery in the United States.
So by this time, skin tone and race had already been identified with privilege and social
absolutely.
Standing.
And, in a way, slavery and freedom was a much more important distinction before the Civil War than black and white. They were rough proxies and pretty good proxies for skin color, but not perfect proxies. And there were plenty of instances where, on the margin, people were allowed into white communities, and the court supported that migration across the color line, in part because what really mattered was that they supported slavery and not how many drops of blood they had flowing through their veins, whatever that means.
I want to talk to John Bowles again about Adrienne Piper and her performance art and the way she confronts us with the concept of race. Tell us about a character she created called Mythic Being.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, this is a character she created in the early 70s, at the height of the Black Power movement, at the era of blaxploitation cinema. When she created this persona, she would dress up as. She'd put on an Afro wig, put on a mustache, mirrored sunglasses, put a cigar in her mouth, a lit cigar in her mouth, wear big heavy army boots. And she'd stride around the streets of Cambridge, Mass., where she was going to school at Harvard. She'd walk around her neighborhood in New York City. And she'd sort of involve herself in a mantra so that she could tune everyone else out, so that she could tune out the judgments of everyone around her. And when she writes about this performance, she writes about it as an experiment to see, on the one hand, how people reacted to her dressed this way, where she's transformed her gender, transformed her, made her racial identity clear. But on the other hand, she also writes about it as an opportunity to see what it's like to be more clearly identified racially. What sorts of, how much is it easier to pass through society if your racial identity is clear? So there's a way in which she, I think, then also wants people who encounter her to have to wonder, does she really look like a man? Does she really look like a black man?
But Daniel Sharfstein, why did this become important, and why did it become important to the law, and particularly well, I guess even before the Civil War, before the end of slavery, why was there a need to create a legal code and better definition?
Well, whenever there was a prospect of freedom for the slaves, then there was a lot more talk about the distinction between black and white and the importance of that line. So in the early 19th century, right after the Revolution, as a lot of people were freeing their slaves, there was talk about there is a movement of people to send African Americans to Liberia, and they justified their position in part by saying that we can't let African American blood taint the white race. So that's the first time you really see a potent biological definition of race and people really building a political position around race. In the 1850s, as abolitionism really rooted itself in Northern politics and culture, again, you see a lot more an outpouring of arguments in the South, essentially espousing what one called the ethnical excellence, the ethnical excellence of slavery. So again, people in the South started talking about drops of blood. And once the Civil War happens and slavery is abolished, black and white becomes the most important division in the U.S. Because this was a pathway to essentially preserve the hierarchy that slavery built in all but name.
On the State of Things this hour, talking about racial politics, identity, privilege, all associated with skin color. My guests are John P. Bowles, a professor of African American art at UNC, and Vanderbilt Law Professor Daniel Sharfstein. We will take your phone calls in the next segment, 877-962-9862. Emails at sot@wunc.org. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour about skin color and racial politics. My guest, UNC Art Professor John P. Bowles, author of Adrian Piper, Race, Gender, and Embodiment. Daniel Sharfstein is with us as well, a law professor at Vanderbilt University, author of The Invisible Line. John Bowles, the questions we've been raising, the idea of when to identify with one race or the other, and a performance like Adrian Piper, who confronts us with our questions and our assumptions about race. I just saw there's a poll again in the New York Times. More white people believe there's now a growing anti-white discrimination. So how important is it that we actually ask ourselves questions about assumptions and what privileges are built in that are invisible, in a sense, to and the work that Adrian Piper does?
Yeah, no, that's an important question. I think what drew me to Adrian Piper's work was the way in which she tries to force us out of the comfort zone of thinking assuming we know who we are. There's a way in which she makes it really clear that that some people are forced by society to be concerned with race on a constant basis, and some people, especially white people, tend to assume that race doesn't particularly matter to us, that we're somehow removed from it, that we're somehow above it. And I think that makes so then many white people become uncomfortable when the question of racial identity comes up. They don't know how to respond. And so I think in Adrian Piper's work, there's an important emphasis on on asking questions, and asking us to think about how we decide who looks white or who looks black, on the emphasis on the visual, right? Why do we think we can tell when we look at somebody whether they're white or black? In what ways is this important to us? In what ways do we need this to feel certain? And so then she uses her own personal stories as a way of kind of leveraging these questions to open things up, to make us start to wonder about ourselves. What's my responsibility? If I think of myself as white, then in what ways am I, and I don't question that, in what ways am I sort of luxuriating in a certain kind of privilege, the privilege of not having to wonder about what that really means.
And Adrian Piper was not the first artist to begin to probe these questions using art. Joining us now to talk about skin color and how it's been addressed in performance is Marvin McAllister. He's an assistant professor of English and African-American studies at the University of South Carolina. Also the author of a forthcoming book called Whiting Up, White-Faced Minstrels and Stage Europeans in African-American Performance. Marvin, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What is a white-faced minstrel?
Well, a white-faced minstrel, you all were just talking about social privilege and whiteness. A white-faced minstrel is a black performer who appropriates or adopts that white privilege, either in a social performative context or in a theatrical context, be it on stage, on film, in a comedy club. So white-faced minstrels plays or responds to black-faced minstrels. See that, hugely popular 19th century popular entertainment. But white-faced minstrels actually predate, the white-faced minstrels I talk about actually predate blackface minstrelsy. Whiteface minstrels, that appropriation of social privileges whites enjoyed, actually goes back to the first contacts between whites and blacks in this country. And as black Negro slaves acculturated and assimilated into the culture, they learned certain codes and gestures and behaviors and attitudes that actually moved them further away from enslavement and closer to liberation. So for me, whiteface minstrelsy predates blackface, but it sort of responds to blackface in some interesting ways as well.
So it's not directly a response since it predates. What was the reason? What do you think was behind it?
Well, whiteface minstrelsy is sometimes or can be confused with the notion of acting white. And the accusation of acting white, you hear that a lot today with African-American students who are high-achieving or corporate African-Americans who are doing well in those structures. You adopt a certain sense of language and codes and attitudes. You learn to code switch to act white in order to progress through the society. And whiteface minstrelsy for slaves in the 1600s and 1700s was a way for them to kind of adopt these codes, assimilate these codes in order to advance through the society, either in social performative context or even in professional context as well. Notions of strategic passing, you act white to get certain things. And so whiteface minstrelsy as social performance was a way for black folks to invade and often question that kind of social privilege. The most famous sort of early whiteface minstrel performer is Homer Plessy, who pretended to be white to get onto a white car in a Louisiana train car. And then he revealed his blackness to contest the separate accommodation laws in Louisiana.
You also write about a man named Bob Cole, a black character actor who used whiteface makeup in his performances. Tell us about him.
Well, Bob Cole is a part of the second sort of component of whiting up, what I call stage Europeans. And stage Europeans are actually a part of a long line of cross-racial play on the American stage, starting in the early 1700s, where white actors appropriated Native American characters through what they called stage Indians. Well, Bob Cole is a part of a tradition where black actors actually appropriate white characters on stage, either in dramatic context or, in his case, comedic context. And so Bob Cole in the 1890s, he was a musical theater performer who was partly in black musical reviews, but partly also in the world of vaudeville performance. And he saw that there was a whole strain of white comedic performers who were doing these kind of eccentric clown-type characters. The most famous later examples are characters like the Tramp character in the I'm blanking on it.
Did he have Willie Wayside?
Yeah. Willie Wayside was his first character, and in his first character, he created a kind of red-bearded tramp type character, and he eventually added the kind of, I would say white face, but I more specifically call it mauve face because it's a very beigey type complexion that he has. It's not like clown cake that you would see in a lot of eccentric clowns, white face clowns in the 1890s.
Well, does this mean that he was going for a more subtle or a nuanced character? This was not caricature.
Exactly, exactly.
Was that dangerous business to be imitating whites on the stage?
In the 1890s, the kind of fresh thing about it is that blackface minstrelsy, although it, you know, in some ways erased a lot of black performers from the American stage, there were black performers still trying to do their thing in vaudeville and in theater houses. And so there was a lot of play by black actors, white actors. There was a lot of play across the racial and color lines. And so there was a lot of talk of black actors doing blackface minstrelsy and being more authentically Negro. And so racial representation was very much at play. I mean, it was like the Wild Wild West in terms of racial representation. So for Bob Cole to do this and other members of his A Trip to Coontown Company, that was the musical that Willie Wayside was a star of, all of his members were performing white characters, Irish characters, Jewish characters, Italian characters, working class white characters from the Lower East Side of New York. And so this was a part of the game. This was a part of the context. And in terms of this sort of media reaction to him performing it, the press mentioned a lot that some white audiences didn't even realize that was a black actor up there performing. And once they realized that, and once the critics made that plain, the critics often made comments like, Bob Cole performed white characters better than white actors perform black characters. So there was no danger in the 1890s. And he's mainly performing on Broadway. He's doing tours of the Northeast. He's doing tours of Canada. He's not going through the South very much to perform these roles. But in the context that he's performing of this musical world, this vaudeville world, it's actually fair game for this kind of cross-racial flow.
Daniel Sharfstein, we've heard a lot about the performance of race and the characterization of race, but the fact is, biologically, there was a lot more mixing than we are given to believe, and the idea that we may all be of mixed ancestry is not too far-fetched. Is that right?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, if we think about the line between black and white, at least as the courts were drawing it, this was a line between people who looked white and other people who looked white. And so this was a distinction that really only had meaning in social context and through performance. One thing that was really fascinating about the conversation with John Bowles is Adrian Piper. She's a fascinating artist, but she's also an amazing writer. And she wrote an essay called Passing for White, Passing for Black, which talked about how people who are right on the line, if they didn't pass for white, if they chose to be African American, often that involved insisting on their African-American identity and articulating it and performing it in very plain ways for shopkeepers and people on the bus and police officers and anyone who would reflexively categorize them as white in a segregated world.
877-962-9862 to join the conversation as Jeffrey has done from Raleigh. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Have a question for us?
Yes, sir. Has education, wealth, success, does that trump skin tone in America now with regard to people's associations or perhaps snap judgments about others?
All right. Thanks, Jeffrey. Go around the table. John Bowles, start with you.
Yeah, I think my answer, looking at Adrian Piper's work, is that they haven't trumped it. That, you know, in a certain way, she's achieved the ultimate success, a PhD in philosophy from Harvard University, became a professor of philosophy at Wellesley College, and yet, you know, takes her Wellesley College photo, her ID photo, and transforms it in an artwork where she colors the background in alarming red and draws in a thought bubble where she seems to be thinking, "What you looking at, mofo?" and titles the work "Self-Portrait as a Nice White Lady." You know, if she's achieved this kind of nice white lady status, once we hear that she's black, can we not see her as white anymore? And what does that really mean?
Marvin McAllister?
I think that in some ways that relates to the sort of post-racial discussion that a lot of people are having on college campuses and other places in an era of Obama as president. And I think that the post-racial discussion tied to achievements like education and that kind of level of progress, I think, are on a college campus like University of South Carolina, where I am, are kind of trumped when you look sort of closely at who are in positions like instructors and professors, and who are in positions like in the service economy, the administrative assistants, the food staff, the custodians, and that kind of thing. And just all you need to do is look at that and see that there are still those kinds of limits, and there's still that kind of caste system, especially in a place like South Carolina, and I imagine in other states, where skin color still hasn't been trumped by educational advancement for some.
Daniel Sharfstein.
Sure. The stories that I write about in my book, I think, show us how race has never really been about blood. In a way, the question about education, wealth, and success go to this core issue. You know, plenty of whites, millions even, have black blood. They're not passing. They're just white people. And so we're left with the question, what is black? And I think that the categories, as the families that I write about show, really have always worked as a proxy for discrimination and hierarchy. So what is race? W.E.B. Du Bois said that people ask me, what is a black man? And I say the answer is easy. The black man's the person who has to ride the Jim Crow car through Georgia. And as long as serious gaps exist in education, in wealth, then race still is a really potent dividing line.
And we still, it is a potent dividing line still, even though these other things, we've made great progress. Why do you think that's true, John? Why have we not gotten past that when we'd like to think we have? Why is race still important? Is it just a hangover, or does it still serve an important purpose?
Well, yeah, there are ways in which race is important to individuals and to communities and groups. There are ways in which racial identification is part of identification with a community. It's part of identifying with a certain rich history or a tradition, with a culture. So there are ways in which race can be a very positive, racial identification can be a very positive thing. The race becomes a problem when it becomes an issue of judgment, when it becomes an issue of looking at somebody, trying to figure out who we think they are, and then treating them as we expect that sort of person to be treated.
Well, Adrienne Piper certainly used her performance to confront us with the question of race and our own assumptions. Marvin McAllister, the comedians, most of whom were the entertainers you talk about, most of them are comedians. Was that therapeutic in any way? Does it heal? Does it create a bond?
I think that, yeah, it does. And a good example of that, two examples of that. One is Richard Pryor. And Richard Pryor was one of the best practitioners of a style of comedy that a lot of people in cultural studies call white people be like comedy. And it's that comedy of racial difference where you juxtapose white ways and attitudes of behaving versus black ways and attitudes of behaving. And what Richard Pryor did through his performance of what white people be like, racial difference comedy, in integrated context, what he did was to start a kind of dialogical conversation between these two different communities in which notions and notions of whiteness and blackness it starts to disappear, and we had fluid notions of race as performative, blackness and whiteness as performative. And the type of work that Richard Pryor was doing, some early work in the 70s and dangerous work in the 70s, has been continued by very skilled code-switching performers like Dave Chappelle or Sarah Jones, who continue this very American idea of race as performative. And I think that a lot of this comedic work, even though it deals with some terrifying type things, examples like police brutality and things like that, and profiling and that kind of thing, and what one of the guests mentioned earlier, this desire or ability of white folks to sort of ignore certain ideas about race and not have to think about it all that much, this type of comedy brings all that to the fore. But in the process, because it's so rooted in this American notion of race as performative, it really, I argue, leads to a potential for healing. Yeah.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Marvin McAllister, Assistant Professor of English and African American Studies at the University of South Carolina. His forthcoming book is called Whiting Up, White-Faced Minstrels and Stage Europeans in African American Performance, available from UNC Press later this year. John P. Bowles, an Associate Professor of African American Art at UNC Chapel Hill. He's the author of the book Adrienne Piper, Race, Gender, and Embodiment, available from Duke Press. Daniel Sharfstein is a law professor at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee. His latest book is called The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. For more information on that, visit danieljsharfstein.com. That's our program for today. Our website is stateofthings.org. You can follow us on Facebook as well. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Galvin Wells and Anna Cassell are our interns. Robin Copley's the technical director. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.